So when you hear about the religious right in the US, you naturally think politics. But many evangelicals are showing another side to their personality. They've launched a calendar featuring scantily clad Christian women. It's caused a lot of controversy because this isn't your grandma's moral majority. Professor Kristen Cobes-Dumais of Calvin College in Michigan wrote the bestseller, Jesus and John Wayne.
It's the Conservative Dad's Real Women of America calendar, where you can see good, wholesome, question mark, conservative women kind of pinup calendar for conservative men that caused a bit of an uproar in some corners of conservatism, particularly the conservative Christian folks. Some of them thought this inappropriate.
Well, I can see why. The Daily Mail reproduced some of the photographs in their online edition. You would not have to be a super conservative Christian to have your doubts, would you? Because, I mean, there's one photograph of a mini-skirted woman posing in front of a crucifix.
Yes, and in a kitchen with some fancy mixers. It's a little bit hard to explain the appeal unless you have a better understanding of, in some ways, what this is reacting against. And so this is seen as a real celebration of quote-unquote traditional womanhood, traditional femininity, playing up women's sexual appeal, trying to celebrate that as a political statement and as a pushback against what they would consider woke America and political correctness. Mm.
Is there any sense, though, that this kind of imagery, especially the use of a crucifix, could be blasphemous? Is there any sense that they were doing that?
I actually didn't hear much along those lines. More the, you know, is this appropriate? Is this the kind of virtuous womanhood that Christians ought to be celebrating? What is conservatism? Is it to celebrate a particular kind of moral agenda and traditional womanhood in a more domestic space? Or is it to celebrate the sexual objectification of women in this heterosexual way? I mean, the truth is modern American conservatism kind of embraces both, depending on where you're coming from. And I think that's what this calendar really broke open, that modern American conservatism, and this has been true for decades, is a kind of coalition between secular conservatives and deeply religious conservative Christians. Mm. And it's always been a kind of tenuous alliance, an alliance that is shaped around a common enemy. So the left, liberals, wokeness, and celebrating a traditionalism, have to put kind of scare quotes around that. But what exactly counts as traditional is kind of up for grabs. And here we see some of the real tensions surface.
Is this calendar marketed specifically or principally at evangelical men?
You know, I think it's fair to say that they were among the members of the target audience. One of the things that has been increasingly true within conservative evangelicalism, and there are certainly exceptions here, and some of those exceptions are the real critics of this calendar, but there's been a growing comfort level with crassness, breaking the rules, not kowtowing to political correctness. It's seen as effeminate, it's not properly masculine. And really in the last decade or so, and certainly in the Trump era, we see an embrace of coarser masculinity, a rugged masculinity, where real men are not polite. Real men are not afraid to fight. And real men, yes, have sexual drives, heterosexual drives. And that is the kind of masculinity that the left wants to destroy. And so in some ways, there's a particular virtue within that framework that can be seen in this calendar.
So just how sexualized has the evangelical right become?
There's been a kind of backlash, and this has been brewing for more than two decades, against the kind of gentlemanly ideal, if you will, against models of servant leadership, what some scholars have called a kind of soft patriarchy, the good father figure, the Ned Flanders type of evangelical, the nice guy. In the early 21st century, we see a lot of books published by Christian publishers with titles like No More Mr. Nice Guy. Mm. Right? That era has come and gone, and Christian men need to step up. I mean, there's actually a song that was sung at some Christian festivals, a Grow a Pair. So they are not subtle about this, that they need to really step up, claim their masculinity, their masculine power. And that is very much put in service of the culture war. And yes, sexual drive is part of that. God filled men with testosterone. You got to do something with that. That's the way God made men. And they need to use that strength and their aggression to do God's work. And the threats are so great, right? The secular culture is out to get us. And this all kind of goes together. So again, a lot can be forgiven, and traditional virtues are framed as kind of effeminate, right? If you look at the Bible, the fruit of the Spirit, things like kindness, gentleness, goodness, self-control, that doesn't really fit with this model of aggressive manhood. And the kind of sexual aggression is within this framework seen as, hey, boys will be boys. It's all part of the package.
Yeah, it's not exactly Jesus as the Lamb of God.
It is not. And in fact, they do not celebrate that particular Jesus. They really like the Jesus from the book of Revelation, the warrior Christ with the bloody sword, right? Who's going to fight the battles and slay all of his enemies.
You know, we're led to the obvious question so much these days. How much of this is because of Donald Trump?
Like I said, this rhetoric and this kind of rugged masculinity and embracing men's sexual drive and really putting the burden of protecting virtue and modesty on women, that goes back decades. That is not new. But Trump has certainly acted as an accelerant. He has really moved things to another level. And what was once, you know, maybe said quietly behind closed doors or, you know, with a wink and a nudge, now is fully embraced in many spaces because Trump's real appeal to conservative Christians who felt embattled, who told themselves they were embattled and who felt like the culture was against them and that they really needed to step up and grow a pair to really fight these battles. When Trump came along, he was not going to follow conventional politics as usual, and they loved him for that. They loved him because he promised to fight for them, and he could do that so well because he was not constrained by traditional virtue. Mm.
I see, Kristen, that two of Donald Trump's most adoring apostles, I'm sure he'd rather like that comparison, having apostles. I'm talking about Congresswomen Lauren Boebert and Nancy Mace. They are prone to present themselves, let us say, in a particular fashion, aren't they? I mean, let's be frank, if you look at the way they pose in photographs, do they identify as Christian warriors?
No, but they have their own roles. Although with Lauren Boebert, it's a bit of a crossover there, I think, too. She will often dress in form-fitting dresses, in a, you might say, sexier style. She's kind of cultivated a particular style of Republican womanhood, Republican femininity, which is both overtly feminine and sexualized, but also aggressive. There's a kind of model there, which is, hey, if the men aren't going to step up, the women are going to have to do this, right? And their target is not usually conservative men, but their target is liberal men. And Sarah Palin really kind of paved the way for this kind of femininity. So she's also crossed the line in terms of being quite crass. She has kind of embraced that Christian warrior mentality. And of course, she got into trouble in a movie theater for groping her date. All of those things a generation ago, or even half a generation ago, would have really killed somebody's political career. And she's still, you know, alive and well. And it just kind of shows the shifting mores. Nancy Mace as well had that infamous slip up where it was at the National Prayer Breakfast. Yeah,
Christian Prayer Breakfast.
Yes. And she told a joke about running a little late because her fiance wanted to draw her back into the bed and there just wasn't time, but she'd get to that, you know, in that evening. kind of tone deaf in terms of her audience and premarital sex. And yes, it provoked a bit of controversy, but not much more than that.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report. We're speaking with Kristen Cobes-Dumais. You may recall our wonderful chat with Kristen not that long ago about her book, Jesus and John Wayne, but we're speaking now about a further development in this story, and that is the hypersexualization of the evangelical right. I don't like questioning people's claims to religious faith or to suggest there's only one way to express your faith, but I've got to wonder how authentic some of these conservatives who make a claim on Christianity are, because, you know, I'm certain that there'd be people who describe themselves as evangelical right who still make the old mistake of thinking that Mary Magdalene was Jesus' mother. They're just not that religiously literate. I mean, is religion a flag of convenience, so to speak, for them?
Yeah, religion is, for many of these folks, it's an identity. It's a cultural identity. It's embracing a certain set of values, political values, cultural values, included among that, this kind of heterosexual, quote-unquote, traditional masculinity, traditional femininity, and a whole host of other issues, right? Views on race and immigration. And what we see here is kind of the signaling of a particular identity. And it's always set against liberals. It's very us versus them, which means if you are a Christian, if you hold to, you know, the same supposed theological beliefs, and if you try to have a theological conversation, but if you don't hold to this identity or if you don't hold to this political agenda, you're not going to actually get very far in these spaces.
It's not just the sexualized poses and the imagery. What's this tendency to trash talk now, vulgarity from certain evangelical preachers?
You know, it's the tough guy. It's breaking the rules. It's showing that you have what it takes. This is not true for all evangelicals, and it certainly isn't true for all evangelical pastors. But again, in the past, this would just be a no-go. You just wouldn't say these things. The condemnation would be resounding. And now that just isn't the case. And there are pastors like Doug Wilson who have been playing this game for a long time and just saying things that are intentionally provocative to provoke liberals, to provoke critics, and then to take pride in that and to somehow associate that you're speaking God's truth. Of course, they're going to critique you. Of course, they're going to be coming after you and building a platform on crossing these boundaries. And that isn't entirely new, but there seems to be much more permission and wider permission within religious spaces and outside of those spaces in recent years.
Speaking of critiques, I noticed that Russell Moore, who's one of the most thoughtful people in the evangelical world, he's a conservative of the old school, not reactionary,
yes,
but he's certainly a conservative. He says that religious conservatives would once rely on liberals to lampoon them. He says now they're debasing themselves.
And he has become a target among these folks, precisely because he is not playing this game. And so you see a divide inside conservative evangelical spaces, conservative Christian spaces, and you can kind of see the attacks. So you have critics like Russell Moore, like David French, who are saying, this is not faithful Christianity. This is not Christian manhood. Come on, guys, this is what we are supposed to stand against. And the attacks against these men are really quite ruthless, right? They are mocked, ridiculed, called not proper Christians. So again, you can kind of see this cultural and political signaling that does take precedence over any common theological foundation, which suggests, you know, maybe there is in fact no common theological foundation underneath this all.
The radical shift here gives you whiplash, because it wasn't just conservative Christians. I mean, if I go back to the mid to late 1990s, when I was a graduate student in the US, even traditional mainline Protestant churches that were by then very liberal in their doctrine were very coy about sex. They weren't censorious or judgmental, but they certainly weren't exhibitionist about it. In fact, it was considered not the done thing to refer to sex in any way in church, and certainly not the done thing to parade your sexual vitality. It's a big shift, because that was how even liberals viewed sex in those days.
You know what's funny, though? It's actually, you know, go back in time there and you talk about the mainline. The mainline were a little bit more buttoned up than evangelicals, because evangelicals, while yes, they're all about purity culture and modesty and these sorts of things, they also had and still have a strand within that tradition, which is to talk a whole lot about sex. All the time. And if you know about American evangelicals, they have this massive kind of popular culture and Christian publishing industry. And I know some of that spills over into Australia as well. And a big piece of that is books on relationships, on sex, on Christian womanhood, Christian masculinity, on marriage. And this is a massive industry. And they actually love talking about sex. And they love talking about how Christians have the best sex. But that sex has to happen within marriage. But then they make a really big deal. You wait before marriage, but as soon as you get married, you're just going to have mind-blowing sex. It's going to be amazing, and we are not prudes, right? So there's this whole literature out there that Christians are actually very comfortable talking about sex and talking about sex from the pulpit and in their small groups, you know, in their devotionals. So it's not quite the leap that it might seem from the outside.
I know what you're referring to when you say buttoned up. I can recall getting a very polite but very very stern sort of lecture about turning up at the Episcopal Church one day without a tie. And I was told that unless it was more than 80 degrees in temperature, I needed to have a tie. Or I didn't need to, but I really should consider wearing a tie. Just before we go, in the end, Kristen, is all of this sex talk, this trash talk, a desperate attempt to be relevant? Is it chasing a youth audience that they are convinced needs this kind of edgy Christianity?
Evangelicals have always really tried to be relevant, certainly in the last 50 years or so. That drive has been in part the result of them feeling like they weren't particularly relevant. It is a pushback against the culture that they feel like demographically they're losing in terms of numbers, in terms of cultural influence, in terms of the Obergefell decision and LGBTQ rights. These sorts of things are making them feel like, hey, maybe we're being marginalized. We need to take back the culture. We need to assert ourselves. There's this kind of warrior spirit, and we're going to have some fun doing it too. And we're going to break the rules, and we're just not playing by your rules anymore. And I think that's really what we're seeing. They're trying to define their own rules and assert their power.
Professor Kristen Cobes-Dumais. She's the author of the book Jesus and John Wayne. Thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.